Not one, but two Republicans jump into the race for mayor of Indianapolis. Will either of them mount a serious challenge? Joe Hogsett stays mum on the competition. Bob Boehning wants to lobby and be a lawmaker. And a committee votes to extend the statute of limitations for rape. That, plus Deflategate and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 23, 2015. Programming
is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, two Republicans announced bids to become mayor of Indianapolis. They are late arrivals to the campaign. One is a member of the Ballard administration. The other is the choice of party leaders. Here is Deputy Mayor Olgin Williams, followed by businessman Chuck Brewer.
I think I'm a credible candidate. My goal is to try to get the community, Republican community, first to support me and put confidence in me and trust that I can do the job that's needed to be done to continue to make this city a healthier city.
About a week ago when, it occurred to me that the party didn't have the right candidate, I stepped forward and said, I want to do this. I want this job, and I could prove myself.
Who will win the Republican primary for mayor? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, which one of those guys is the favorite?
Well, you're forgetting that Jocelyn Tandy Allende,
Donde,
filed as well.
And
you have two men and a woman in the race, yes. And I don't know that you can predict who's going to win that. And
there's actually another Terry Michael, who is a township trustee, is in the race.
Well, I mean, they could have a knockdown,
What I'm saying is these two have the best chance to be the nominee.
You're saying that.
I'm saying that.
Oh, okay. And so what does that do to the candidacy? On both fronts or what?
Which one would the Democrats rather face?
We don't care. It's not going to matter.
That's because they're not going to win, I guess, is what she's saying. Olgin Williams has done an outstanding job. He's been a great civic leader in this community, done a great job for Mayor Ballard. But at the end of the day, our nominee is going to be Chuck Brewer.
He's got a name ID problem.
Well, Chuck Brewer is, a Marine, 23-year veteran. He's a small business developer here in this community. He's worked for a Fortune 500 company, a Northwestern MBA grad. He's got an outstanding resume, and he's growing jobs in this community. In fact, he's a great recognizer of talent. Josh Kaufman, the guy that won the Voice last year, used to perform at Potbelly's.
He's the one that started at his sandwich shop.
That's right.
On the Circle.
Sandwich shop. Okay.
He owns two restaurants downtown, a sandwich shop and a soup.
And I understand. In fact, I've seen Joe Hogsett in Potbelly's before. So he thinks it's pretty good.
Maybe that speaks well for Mr. Brewer's occupation currently, and maybe he needs to stay in it.
And I can tell you that I asked Joe Hogsett what he thinks of the food there, and he said no comment. He didn't want to get dragged into it.
I guess the quickest route to a voter's heart is through his or her stomach. But in this case, I think the more important thing is going to be the ability to raise enough money, have access to enough money to get the message out, and also grassroots support. When you're talking about fending off intra-party challengers, right, that's significant. So the fact that the County Republican Party went out and basically has anointed
Well, he's the only candidate that has filed for slating, and so he will be our nominee.
He has had a meteoric rise in some ways because I think he was...
He
was running for council 24 hours earlier, and they said, well, if you're willing to do that, maybe it could slot you over here. That is a pretty quick jump.
He's the one that came to him and said...
He said he wanted to do this, and in fact, he said he will do some self-financing, although he won't say how much. I mean, is he going to have to put a lot of his own money into this to make it work?
Well, remember, the person who holds the office now had very little money, had many of the same credentials, and was able to win against a well-financed candidate.
And was running against an incumbent who imploded.
That's the big difference here. Yeah. You have no incumbent in the race. You have a Democrat Party that sure seems at this point like it's very intent upon winning a race that it should have won the last two times around. So I think Mr. Brewer has a very difficult challenge in front of him. He will have to invest, I think, a fair amount of his money into the race to prime the pump, and then he's going to have to perform well. He's going to have to show well in polls. He's going to have to be all over the community. If he does those things, then some of the money may come, and he may have a shot at making this a competitive race, but it's a very tough pull for him.
Yeah, if he's in a position to put $3 million in the race, I think he would be a contender. Because then you could pay attention to him. Otherwise, he's not going to be relevant. The difference, besides the incumbent and whatever you want to say about the campaign, the problem then was people were so upset about property taxes. And it was an anti-vote. It wasn't a pro-vote, which is why Mayor Ballard was elected in the first place. It had nothing to do with Mayor Ballard.
Second time around, we re-elect
incumbents, barring some major scandal.
That's one issue, but think also just the raw numbers of the district. There are more, the sheer number of Democrats in within the city limits now who would vote. It's a greater percentage now than it was then. Even then. Right. So that's
Republicans didn't do well in Marion County in 2014.
It certainly was not a great day here in Marion County, but city elections tend to be different here, and voters discern things differently, not always just along party lines, as we've seen in the past.
Yeah, but even with the Republicans' attempts to suppress the vote, which there's been a concerted effort on the Republican Party's part, we're still going to carry Marion County.
Time now. 15. For viewer feedback, each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, who will be the Republican nominee for mayor of Indianapolis? Your choices are A, Terry Michael, B, Chuck Brewer, C, Olgin Williams, or D, Jocelyn Tandy Adonde. Last week's question, does Indiana need a balanced budget amendment? 11% said yes, 82% said no, 7% said what would it do? If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Democrat Joe Hogsett has managed to get 6 months' worth of publicity out of his decision to enter the race for mayor and little more. So far, he has done everything possible to avoid controversy. Hogsett appeared at the city-county building with his wife, Stephanie, to make his candidacy official this week. He filed his paperwork, obtained a copy from the clerk's office, and then went on his way, stopping only briefly to answer questions. When asked, he declined to say anything about the two Republicans who entered the race this week.
Not here to talk about politics today. I filed my candidacy, and frankly, this is less about who's running and more about what the people of Indianapolis expect from their next mayor. I really don't and don't intend to comment on any of my opponents. I'm going to focus on the vision that I have for the future of the city, and I hope it is responded to by the voters.
Tim Berry, how long can Hogsett keep that strategy going?
Well, how long can the media allow that to happen? He's milked the story pretty well for 6 months now, talking about running, and hasn't really been able to avoid talking about real issues for the most part. Now that he's filed, hopefully we can have that discussion about the future of the city.
He's made it clear that he thinks crime will be the top issue and believes that as the former U.S. attorney, he's in a position to take advantage of that. Is that enough?
Well, that's a large part of it. I mean, certainly the crime statistics under Mayor Ballard's watch have been abysmal. Obviously that gives a great deal of discussion points. The roads, education, I mean, there are a lot of issues that he'll be discussing if and when the Republicans ever get a candidate that's viable.
He reported $1.4 million on hand at the first of the year. He's in pretty good shape.
His finances are in much better shape than the city's, for instance. I think that's going to be a major issue mm-hmm. for the next administration. Not to say that the city's upside down right now, but there are a lot of challenges for funding for the city going forward, and I think that's going to be a major issue for the next administration. So $1.4 million is an impressive number, and throughout $3 million earlier for the Republican opponent, I'm sure that Joe Hogsett will have that much and probably more by the time this race is run. So it's going to be an expensive race probably, and he looks like he's going to be well-financed.
One of the things that the Republicans have discovered in their research is that in the last 10 years, only two Democrats have lost Marion County in countywide races, and one of them is Joe Hogsett.
Yes, if
that's when he ran for Attorney General in 2004.
Steve Carter.
And that's when he stood for Attorney General in 2004. He didn't run for Attorney General in 2004.
Well, if that's so, is this election going to be anything different, though?
No, your candidate's going to stand
Joe
for Hogsett election the same way.
Joe Hogsett has lost elections, no doubt. His fair share he's lost. But if that's the best opposition research you can come up with, that's probably not going to carry the day. He, because of the funding, because of the name ID, because of sort of the profile, clearly he's in the driver's seat. And when you started by asking why he didn't want to talk about his answer questions the other day, I'm not so sure he didn't want to talk about his candidacy in his race. I think what this was, he didn't want to talk about his opponents. Well, which
he didn't want to talk, I'm telling you, he didn't want to talk about that much either. He wanted that to be a photo op.
To the point that he doesn't want to talk about his opponents, who could blame him? Because if you're seen as the heir apparent and all but a declared winner, and you have people who are upstarts who aren't funded, why give them this? Put them on the same platform?
It's also greasy kid stuff. On the first day that he announces to come out with guns blazing, that's something that Tim does regularly, but most people don't do when the opposition's declaring a candidate. The way you get in trouble in these things is to try to interfere or influence in someone else's primary.
Well, I'm talking about trying to figure out how he wants to lead the city. And I think that's what we're going to hear from Chuck Brewer about the future.
Hogsett says
community.
He'll start unveiling his vision.
But if you're looking
there's
for
plenty of time between now and the
if you're
election.
Looking for precedent for people, well-known candidates who've decided not to talk about their opponents, mm-hmm. how about Mike Pence in the last gubernatorial campaign? I don't think he talked about issues, but he let other people, including Tim here, talk about the opponents.
To the State House. The chairman of the Indiana House Education Committee has formed a lobbying company to represent clients in the education field. Representative Bob Boehning formed Berkshire Education Strategies last June. He's looking to represent a student testing company called Questar in Oklahoma. He says he only intends to represent clients out of state and has submitted a draft contract with Questar to the House Ethics Committee for its consideration, and this just in, he has withdrawn the request for approval from the House Ethics Committee. John Ketzenberger, did he have any option there?
I really don't think so for a couple of reasons. One, as chairman of the Education Committee, even if he's lobbying in other states, Questar has a contract in Indiana. People could raise a question of conflict in that case. And really, given the session that the leadership in both chambers have said and have said is important, is dealing with ethics questions. We saw last session with a major ethics situation involving Representative Turner. I don't think there's much appetite for these kinds of conflicts to come up, and I think he accurately read the situation, realized that he wasn't going to get approval from the Ethics Committee, decided to take it down.
And ethics reform is the top priority of House Speaker Brian Bosma, and it's been reported he discouraged Boehning from doing this. Even if you don't question his judgment, his timing doesn't seem to be good.
I was going to say, Jim, this is an example how timing is everything. I think if we had not had the Eric Turner situation that John alluded to, and this had not been thrust on leadership, and it's not just Brian Bosma, I think we have all caucus leaders saying that this is a priority and that they will work together. Had that not been the case, maybe this would have been treated differently, but you can't, in the wake of what happened. On the other hand, I mean, you have to say, this is putting it forth and seeking the approval, mm-hmm. is probably a step ahead of the old days, which is just doing.
You have a statute out there,
which is
too,
I know, but
that
which is but there were many in the past who would just do it and then answer questions later.
Well, this isn't about timing. This is about judgment. We're not talking about an incidental conflict here. We're talking about creating an entity. And you're telling me that when this Quaestar looked out over the entire universe in the United States of possible people who could help them with lobbying, they focused on Bob Boehning? And the fact that they have a very lucrative contract in Indiana and he's the chairman of the Education Committee had no consideration in this? Give me a break. You can't even make that case with a straight face.
Does it make sense for someone, you know, whatever the circumstance, does it make sense to be a lawmaker in one state and a lobbyist in another?
Well, you've got to recognize that we have a citizen legislature in the state of Indiana.
But I understand that.
And as a result, you're going to, and we also have to realize that Brian Bosma and David Long are committed to ethics legislation this session, and we're going to see things in more concrete form over the next few weeks and months to deal with these types of situations.
Do these developments help their cause?
Well, I think that this was an issue that they were going to address whether this development came up or not. I think Bob was trying to be forthright and create firewalls and be transparent, but at the end of the day, it wasn't in the best judgment and in the best interest, and he withdrew the request.
The problem with this is, as I say, conflicts arise with a citizen legislature. I understand that. He created this conflict. He was using his position on the Education Committee to make money with a contractor with the state government in other states. If you don't see what's wrong with that, you know, you cannot legislate judgment.
Well, he hasn't worked professionally in the education field.
Before this, either.
This,
he was a florist, which is a perfectly good profession, but has nothing to do with education policy.
Moving on. Right now, the Indiana statute of limitations in some rape cases is just 5 years, but that could change in the near future. Three victims shared their stories this week in a state Senate committee in the effort to create a statute of limitations that would last to 10 years in some cases. Joy Ryder is one of them.
It's taken me 25 years to come forward, which it takes most victims. It is known that it takes 1 to 2 decades for someone to feel strong enough to come forward and tell their story and to get help.
John Schwanis, is there any opposition to that bill?
I don't know if opposition maybe is the right word. How about caution? There are people, I think, who, because this is happening in other states and it's been embraced in other states, all because of the dramatic advances in science. I mean, DNA has changed. It's a game changer in terms of connecting people to crimes. But
a big motivator here is the case where a man came
confessed.
In and admitted to a rape that he'd committed 9 years ago.
But that is right in this case. But you'll have others where, for instance, you have DNA samples of arrestees or incarcerated individuals, and there will be some sort of sweep, and this person has said, oh, there's a match here with a crime that had occurred. I think when I say caution or reservation, everybody wants people who do bad things to get punished for it. Is that the defendants are entitled under our system to a defense, and what if the alibi witnesses, if they are, this is an extreme case, if it's 50 years ago or 20 years
nobody says you're going to automatically find these people guilty.
Right.
They're going to go through the legal system.
Right, but
that's the point. You've got either DNA or a confession. So you've got outside evidence of a crime that it's pretty difficult to rebut. And 10 years is not unreasonable. The reason you have a statute is when it's just one word against another, you have to recreate what you were doing 9 years ago, maybe difficult, probably not any more difficult than 4.5 years ago.
The witnesses you may be able to secure in 2 or 3 or 4 years.
And what are they going to say? It's not your DNA?
I'm not defending. I think I said bad people should be punished.
I think what you've got is a situation where we look at the reason, and Ann said the reason for statute of limitation exists, it's too short. You're talking about a traumatic crime, a crime that can cause people to go into a shell and not want to deal with this and not be able to deal with this. So I think this is an attempt to recognize that particular situation in these cases and give them more time to be able to process this if it comes after that 5-year period and still try to get justice.
I think
this is one bill in a package of 4 or 5 that Republican leadership is pursuing as a way to tell the public that they're taking crime seriously.
They're taking crime seriously, and quite frankly, this is proof positive that legislators really take into account issues that their constituents have. In this case, a constituent brought this to the attention of Senator Kreider. They had discussion. They realized there was a problem. He drafted a bill and even found innovative way to allow her to testify. Now lives in Oregon,
right.
And she testified by Skype this week to present the case.
And she deserves a lot of credit, it seems to me, for coming forward on that.
I agree.
She does.
Indiana Senator Dan Coats got a reward this week. He was named chairman of a subcommittee of the Senate Finance Committee. He also spoke out about the State of the Union address, saying it's sort of like the president and Congress are on different planets.
His agenda has no chance of getting approved in this Congress. There are even Democrats. Take Keystone Pipeline. 10 Democrats supported Republicans, and the president said, send me that, and I'm going to veto it. So it's even affecting his own party, and even they are saying, wait a minute, Mr. President, I thought we were going to work together.
Tim Berry, what does Senator Coates' new status mean for Indiana?
It's great. I think this is even more proof positive of the level of respect and influence that Senator Coats has within the Senate and within the Senate leadership to continue to move projects and programs forward, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline legislation, other legislation to grow our economy, and quite frankly, at a time where this world is seems to be more and more dangerous. His expertise and experience on the Intelligence Committee is going to be invaluable.
He's with the Intelligence Committee, the Finance Committee. His role has improved here considerably.
It has, and I hope it'll bear fruit for Indiana. We could certainly use it. I don't know that the Keystone Pipeline does anything for us, but I hope that he is in a position to assist the state in securing good-paying jobs
and
the good education
system. Well, it will if the president
system.
Doesn't veto it. So.
Even if the president signs it, it doesn't have any impact on us. All that oil goes out of the country. And by the way, in case you haven't noticed, gas prices are a record low, which is, of course, thanks to the president and his policies.
Senator Coats was kind of rough on the president after the State of the Union. Is that a surprise?
No. I think Republicans see this as an opportunity, and you know, I think Senator Coats recognized that as well, and I think he said what he felt like he should say in that situation.
You know, one of the things the president did in the State of the Union was try to send the message to Congress that he's been elected twice
and
he's still Commander in Chief.
That's right, and there was derisive laughter in the chamber at one point. So,
yeah.
You know, I think he was speaking to an audience that doesn't see that the same way he does. Well, I would like to see Congress and the president, regardless of partisan situation, work together and try to get some things done for the country that need to be done, because with all of this, you know, lollygagging around that we've had for the last 10 years, we're falling behind, and the respect of the United States in the eyes of the world has diminished.
It's declining.
And you know, we are really on the
it's
precipice of frittering
well.
Away, you know, our ability to be a leader in the world.
And yeah. Any president deserves the right to have his ideas heard in committee and voted on.
Quickly.
I was going to say, the chairmanship is good for Dan Coats and it's good for Indiana. And I say that because any time, and I don't care if it's R or D or Senate or House, when you have members of the delegation move into leadership positions and get more clout, I mean, and more able to hold sway, that's a good thing for the home state, period, regardless of party affiliation.
Finally, Deflategate is the talk of the sporting world and beyond this week. It's the allegation that the New York Patriots cheated in the playoff game against the Colts in the NFL round. The NFL found that 11 of 12 footballs used by the Patriots were deflated. Deflating footballs can make them easier to throw and catch. The Patriots won 45-7, sending the team to the Super Bowl. Here's what Patriot coach Bill Belichick had to say.
My overall knowledge of football specifications, the overall process that happens on game day with the footballs is very limited. I would say that during the course of the game, probably has happened on an incomplete pass or something, but I've never touched a game ball. That's not something that I have any familiarity with on that. And again, I was completely and totally unaware of any of this that we're talking about in the last couple of days until Monday morning. So based on what I know, knew Sunday night, thinking back on this, which I've done several times, really can't think of anything that I would have done differently based on what I knew then, based on what I know now. I told you the one change we would make in the initial start level of the football pressure, but that's really about it.
Sorry we let him go on so long there, but we were trying to get him to say something. And Delaney's, is he telling the truth?
I wonder how many times he had to practice that answer.
Well, he didn't do very well.
And I also think, though, that when you juxtapose the word honestly or truthfully in the middle of your answer, I always wonder what came before that and going forward. Yeah. Look, but the worst thing about this entire scandal is that you're asked to watch the clips of that game over and over again.
That's true. Yeah. It's true. It wouldn't have made a difference in that game. Are they cheaters?
Patriots?
Yeah.
You're legitimately asking that question? Come on, Jim. I think we all have seen that there's a history there of that.
Yep. The balls may be deflated, but certain members of the staff are clearly still full of hot air.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T, rethink possible.